Welcome to the Clubhouse with Shane Bacon. I'm your host, Shane Bacon. This week's episode with Kemper Sports President Josh Lesnik is brought to you by OGO. The great folks at OGO sent me a Renegade backpack the other day. I'm telling you, people, this thing has more pockets than gadgets you could ever own. Water bottle pocket, a safety sleeve for your tablet, an armored protection compartment for your laptop. Yes, armored indeed. I'm about to embark on a massive journey, and I wouldn't want to do it with anything except my Renegade OGO backpack. Check that out and plenty more at OGO.com, OGIO.com. I mentioned a journey. I will not be around for the next couple of weeks, so I urge you and tell you to go check out a couple of old episodes here at the Clubhouse if you need your fill. First one, episode 26 with Bob Parsons, founder of PXG. PXG continues to be more and more popular. Bob is very honest and very open about his company, the plans, the hopes, the dreams of it. And it was a really interesting conversation to have with Mr. Parsons. So check that one out. And also, I urge you to do one a couple of weeks ago, episode 52 with the New York Times, Karen Krause. We talked a whole bunch about covering golf for Karen, the PGA Tour, the Masters, her old battle with Augusta National, and maybe what the Olympics are going through right now. So those are a couple to check out. Those are the ones I push you towards. The USGA, as you know, unveiled a huge change of the rules on Wednesday. I wanted to do a quick breakdown of it with Thomas Pagel, Senior Director of Rules and Amateur Status for the USGA. So I gave him a ring. So let's get to that right now. Thomas Pagel, really instrumental in this enormous undertaking by the USGA with this rules change. He's up next on the Clubhouse. The USGA unveiled a huge change to the rules on Wednesday, and I wanted to do a quick breakdown of it with Thomas Pagel, Senior Director of Rules and Amateur Status for the USGA. Thomas, first, I appreciate you taking some time. I know you're very busy with this, and I know you're very excited, but I wanted to ask, the first time you guys have done this type of a massive review of the rules to this extent since 1984, how long has this particular review gone on for behind the scenes?
Well, Shane, first, thanks for having me today. Yeah, we are very excited to be previewing a major set of rules changes that will take effect on January 1st, 2019. You know, our traditional four-year cycle, or traditional cycle, is to look at the rules every 4 years. But every now and then, you have to step back and really take a fundamental review, and that's what we've done. And this is the first time since 1984, as you've said, that we've really undertaken a fundamental review of the rules, and it was really an opportunity to bring the rules up to date, to meet the needs of the changing game globally, to identify how we can make the rules easier to understand, easier to apply for golfers everywhere.
And you've said it, Thomas, and I think that really the rules can be very confusing, let's be honest. I mean, a lot of people can be confused at times by what this means and what that means, and of course what happened last year, you know, with the U.S. Open with Dustin, and it was kind of a look by everybody to decide on what really went down there. Is this just basically a chance for you guys and for everybody in golf to allow a layman's look at it and a layman's rule book so people can understand these a little bit easier?
Yeah, I mean, we recognize, you know, and I'll be the first one to say that the rules are complex. The way that they're written and delivered is legalistic, and we wanted to move away from that. We wanted to identify, again, how can we write the rules and deliver the rules so that they're easy to understand, easy to apply. You can find the answers that you're looking for. And when you get into the book, you know, they're written in a more modern and plain language that's, you know, less dense, less complex. So we're really excited, again, about what we're previewing for 2019 and look forward to what people have to say about it.
Yeah, you know, I read through them. The word that keeps popping up that I'm seeing is the word relaxed, a relaxed putting green rule, relaxed rules for penalty areas, relaxed bunkering, and some of the rules around that. Are these rules that are focused for the amateur golfer, or is this going to go all across golf, including professionals?
So this will apply to golfers throughout the world at all levels. You know, we're committed to a single set of rules being a great benefit for the entire game. It really ties all golfers together to have, you know, that one set of rules. So when you tee it up, you know, you're playing the same courses under the same equipment, under the same rules. And we think that that's one of the certainly unique quality to the game of golf, but one of the great assets of the game of golf. So the changes you're seeing, they'll apply to you playing at home on Saturday, but they'll also apply to the professionals that you watch on Sunday.
So when you see something like no penalty if a ball's played from the putting green and it hits an unattended flag stick in the hole, I mean, this is something that I believe that, you know, real hardcore golfers are almost going to have to pay almost more attention to than maybe your regular average player, because, you know, these are things that we at the core have known to be rules all the time. So is this a look at maybe people that don't play golf and say, hey, you know, come do this, we're not going to be sticklers about this? Or is this, you know, maybe more for the professional golfer and people out there that love the game that have just kind of asked for things like this for a number of years and are just excited to hopefully be able to play golf and not necessarily feel like anything they're due, they're maybe stepping on eggshells with?
You know, Shane, I think one of the objectives here, and one of the great, in my opinion, things about this initiative is the fact that our starting point was to look at this again for all golfers everywhere and for people that, you know, maybe somebody that's interested in the game of golf. And so it's changes that are more intuitive, proposed changes that perhaps are not as nitpicky or hair splitting or controversial, but also just changes in generally that make the rules themselves less intimidating. We think that this will have an impact that can make the game more approachable.
Yeah, I mean, I think less intimidating is a great way to put it, because it does seem like when you read through them, and I, you know, I push people to go do that. Make sure you get a look at this, because I do think reading through them will help you understand them a little bit better. I was going to ask you in particular. I know you're a guy that, you know, has pushed for this and that over the years. Which of these new rules are you the most excited about? Which one was maybe your baby when you kind of started to look back at some of these and review it?
Well, I'll tell you that there's a you would not believe the amount of work that's been put behind the proposals that we're previewing today. It's been a hugely collaborative effort between the USGA, the RNA, as well as our friends at the PGA Tour, European Tour, who've been in the room since day one, and of course all of our other associations that participate as part of our Rules of Golf Committee cycle. So I don't know that I have one that's my baby, but I can tell you the one that I'm most excited about has to do with reasonable judgment, and essentially what that rule is going to state is if a player is operating under a rule and they do what is reasonable in taking relief or in putting a ball into play, and some other evidence later shows that they got it just a little wrong, so we're talking video evidence here, players no longer going to be penalized. There's no reason for us to scrutinize that. So, you know, if you're putting your ball into play and you happen to be an inch away from where you should have been, as long as you as the player were doing what was reasonable, that's okay. We're going to accept that. There's no reason for a penalty to apply in those situations. So I think that's a great change. I think it'll be well received. And yeah, I'm really excited to hear what people have to say about it.
Well, and players have to be excited. I mean, that's something that I feel like players will really get behind, because, again, this is something where, you know, golf is such a game of inches, you know, not just because you miss a putt, but as you mentioned, a drop here or there, and you get called in from the phone. So, you know, it almost takes that power away from people at home watching and calling in and allowing the players, as you said, to be reasonable. I mean, the game is complicated. The rules can be complicated. So it's nice for that. I'm sure the players are excited to hear that as well.
Yeah, and you know, it's again, I think if you look at this initiative and how it applies across the game, you know, you look at other examples that are going to benefit all of us that go out and play every single weekend on our favorite golf courses. And the one you mentioned earlier about the flag stick, I think that's a great one. Just, you know, I've got a 40-foot putt. We're all internal optimists. We think we're going to make it. Today we're walking forward 40 feet to pull that flag stick out so we don't get penalized. You know, in the future, just leave it in there. And if you're lucky enough to hit it, that's okay. There's no reason for a penalty. Or, you know, little things like being able to move loose impediments in a bunker. The challenge is still going to be there from playing out of the sand. Why not be able to move that twig or that leaf that's near our ball? So I think you're going to see a lot of examples throughout that are going to impact the game at all levels. And I think players at all levels are going to really receive well. As you mentioned earlier, I mean, USGA.org /rules, a tremendous amount of resources available there. Not only the full draft code available for people to read, but also videos to explain the proposed changes, number of infographics. So there's a lot of materials out there for folks to review and then engage as part of this feedback period.
I can tell you, I've got a couple of friends of mine, Thomas, that are going to be the most excited about this, being able to pull your ball out of a bunker and take a two-shot penalty so they're not just in there digging sand day after day, hour after hour, and taking a 15 or a 16 on a hole. I know a couple of guys that I play a lot of golf with hate to be in bunkers. So I'm excited about it. I mean, really, the European Tour, the PGA Tour, the RNA, and the USGA, I just feel like the last year and a half, they're really pushing towards a more fun game. And I think that's really exciting, in particular with the rules. So I'm excited about it. I appreciate you taking some time to chat with us just about this, because I know y'all at the USGA are excited about it, and we are as well. And with that, I will let you go. And I will say this, I cannot wait till Erin Hills. We're going to be out there in May, but really when the festivities get going for the U.S. Open, I know everybody will be excited.
Yeah, Shane, I appreciate you having me today, and I look forward to seeing you out there at Erin Hills.
It looks like I'm a wreck. It's in the hole! It's in the hole!
If you're a cart guy, you need to go to Ogio.com right now and take a look at their Silencer bag. This thing is the Suburban XL of golf bags with every compartment you'd ever want and a home away from home on the golf course. Ogio is a leader in golf bags for those that like to walk and those that like to ride, and their selection is rivaled by no one when looking for a new bag. Trust me, your golf bag could use an upgrade. Check out Ogio.com right now and see what the Silencer is all about. Many thanks to Thomas for jumping on. Now, a really fun and interesting conversation with Kemper Sports president Josh Lesnik here on The Clubhouse. And as I mentioned, excited about this conversation, inviting Josh Lesnik into The Clubhouse. Josh, I wanted to start where things probably started for you, really, in a sense, at Bandon Dunes. People know if they follow me at any instance, they know I'm obsessed with Bandon Dunes. But you were the GM at Bandon Dunes when the whole thing kind of got going. So I just wanted to say and kick these things off by saying, when did Bandon Dunes go from Bandon Dunes to, oh my God, it's Bandon Dunes, and every golfer wanted to go and get a chance to be there and it be as busy as it is today?
You know, Shane, that's a great question. It was really amazing. I recall, you know, we opened the first golf course, Bandon Dunes, in May 2nd of 1999. And I remember, you know, at that point, talking to Mike Kaiser, obviously, a lot, every day, multiple times a day. And we had decided we were going to start taking reservations for Bandon Dunes, just the first course, January 1st of 1999. And then in early December, the golf writer for the Oregonian, his name was Bob Robinson, a longtime, well-respected golf writer in the, you know, the Portland newspaper, came down, visited the property, and he wrote a pretty darn glowing article about Bandon, because there was a lot of disbelief about it, believe it or not. You know, people were like, no one's going to go down there to play golf. It's too far away. But he wrote this article like, people are going to go there. And when that article went live in the paper, the phone started ringing at Bandon Dunes. It was just me and of course, you know, someone you know well, Shu. Shu worked in the office with me, and he was answering phones, and all of a sudden, we couldn't keep up with the phones. They were ringing so much, just from really that article. And honestly, the phones have never stopped ringing from that point. So, you know, at that point, you know, so a month into it, 2 months, then in March of 99, some national golf writers came down, actually from Golf Week, and they played it, or their story came out in March. They came actually earlier in 98, and the story came out in March. And Bandon Dunes was ranked in their top 10 modern courses before it even opened. And they wrote a story, about Bandon Dunes, about Mike Kaiser. And again, the phones continued to ring. It was a top 10 debut, which they said had never happened. And it started to become Bandon Dunes. It really did.
Well, you know, it's so interesting because if you get a chance to go to Bandon, I mean, if you go down towards the bunker bar and you walk through those halls, you can almost feel, and it's funny to say the history because, as you mentioned, it hasn't been around for a long time, but, you know, those articles are plastered on the wall there. I mean, and these are articles from, you know, 99, 2000, 2001, times like that where, you know, it doesn't seem like it was that long ago, but that was how things got out. I mean, it's, you know, you're talking pre-Twitter, pre-Instagram, pre-all of that, so you were still going to a magazine to read about a new place that opened. And of course, my dad, who, you know, will call me 4 months after I play a place and mention that, hey, have you seen this course? And I'm like, yeah, I already went there. Remember, I told you about it. You know, he's not necessarily on the Instagram button, but it is funny how news travel. And to hear it traveling that fast, were you guys expecting this to be a lot of locals initially, people in the area, you know, driving up from Coos Bay, places like that? And then all of a sudden, it's this boom, and you're going, how are we going to facilitate and handle this many people embarking on this golf course?
Yeah, you know, we thought for it to be successful, we did think people would have to come down from Portland and come from Eugene. And, you know, Oregon is a big state in terms of land mass, but there were only 2 million people at the time that lived in the state, and some of them pretty far away from Bandon. So, you know, we knew people would have to come from further away, and we thought, you know, if it was as good as we thought it might be, that maybe even they'd come down from Seattle or come up from San Francisco. And but honestly, the flooding that first year that we got of people coming down there was a huge surprise to Mike and to myself, to all of us really involved, because we were just this little thing. And as you said, you're right, there wasn't the Twitter sphere and the Instagram or Facebook, any of it. And, you know, the word got out so fast, I think because, you know, it was so different. And when people got there, it was so good, and it actually lived up to whatever expectation or hype they had. It exceeded it. And so they went home with this really excited message, and it just kept growing.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned it's not an easy place to get to. It's gotten easier, of course. You know, there have been flights added from Denver, and you can get up from San Fran, places like that. But, I mean, it's not easy to get there. It really isn't. I mean, you're basically having to live by the mantra that have clubs will travel. Something I have noticed with Kemper in particular is they're not scared of these places that are kind of remote. I mean, I've been to Prairie Club. It is not easy to get to. You know, you talk about Stream Song. It's easier to get to, but Florida people think it's in the middle of nowhere, which I always find funny. You know, Bandon is kind of, you know, somewhere in the middle of nowhere. Does that come into play when you guys are looking at properties, or do you understand that, you know, golfers will go wherever, and almost in a sense, if you're going to go on a golf trip, it's kind of nice to be kind of out of touch with reality?
You know, well, I think this was sort of the pioneering that Mike Kaiser did. Maybe, you know, he would credit Sandhills as the first one that went somewhere where the land was great for golf, not too worried about, you know, the demographics or the geographics or where people lived, but, you know, almost harks back to the old days of, you know, look, when Pebble Beach was built, I think it took people, I don't know, a day in a horse and carriage to get down there from San Francisco. That wasn't easy to get to, but it was a beautiful place for golf. And, you know, that trend, which you know, maybe started with Sand Hills, but got pretty darn big with Bandon Dunes, was if we go and build a great golf course, you know, it's not that it doesn't matter where it is, but, you know, these remote locations are okay because it makes for great golf. And that's what people have. And that was really part of Mike's vision. You know, Mike had spent years with his buddies going over to Scotland and Ireland and thinking, gosh, wow, if we could build that type of golf here in the U.S., it would really be different because there's nothing like it. And maybe all those people that are going over there would like it and come here. And, you know, sure enough, that's what he was able to do. Now, as far as our company, you know, it's interesting because Kemper Sports was really born out of a PR company. I mean, my dad, who co-founded the company with Jim Kemper Jr., was a PR person. He's a great PR person. That's what he was known for. It's what he did. He didn't even play golf at the time, Shane. You know, he really had two things that you know, I still see as characteristics in our company. And that is one, public relations. And two, he's crazy about service in terms of hospitality, food and beverage. He just, you know, if he didn't have twice as much food as you needed for a party, it just, everybody was in trouble. He really had a passion. You know, he just had a passion for that. And if you look at being born out of a PR company, I mean, that's what our company does, is we make the course and the client the star. And they really are the star. We're behind the scenes like a PR company would be. And we do whatever kind of custom fit, unique solutions might be needed at that property to make it successful. But you might not even know that Kemper Sports is there, and that's okay.
Well, it's part of, I mean, I did my bachelor party at Bandon Dunes, and it was part of the reason I did it was, I mean, I have a relationship with them. I mean, they're amazing. If you guys ever want to hear about me talk about Band of Dunes, you can go listen to the old podcast today with Matt Ginella, because we basically just talked about how great it was for 45 minutes. But, you know, it is a place where if you want to change a tee time or do this or mix it up, it doesn't seem like it's a big overtaking. That's something that I did feel like, as you mentioned, that this kind of comparison to Scotland golf. One thing I have always felt like when I went over to Scotland to play golf was, this is your itinerary. This is what you're doing. You're not going to change it. That's the bottom line. I mean, you're lucky to get a tee time at the Old Course. You know, you feel privileged to play a place like Carnoustie, you know, or if you get on Muirfield. I always have felt like that's what you're set to do. And there's been times where I've been abandoned and said, hey, you know, the group I'm with doesn't want to play Old Mac again, or they don't want to play, you know, Pacific again. They want to go play trails. And boom, they say, yeah, not a problem. And it's almost like they're annoyed that you even asked the question, because you know the answer is going to be yes. You know, it's a very nice feeling when you feel like that. But I don't want to spend all the time talking about Band. And I did want to get into kind of the golf business. I mean, you're in the golf business in a sense. So my first question about the golf business is this. All we've been hearing the last 4 or 5 years is that golf is struggling. So I ask you, Josh, is the golf business struggling?
Well, you know, I think there's no doubt that, you know, and it's all depending how you measure it and what parts of the business you measure, but that the number of golfers and the number of rounds has shrunk and might continue to shrink a little bit. But it's also true that numbers in other sports have shrunk. Numbers in, you know, kids playing football, kids playing basketball, kids playing hockey, you know, soccer wasn't that big a sport when I grew up. I'm dating myself a little bit, but soccer is a huge sport now in the U.S. and more kids are playing soccer. So it's evenly spread amongst all these sports. So, you know, I do agree that the number of golfers and number of rounds has been shrinking. I don't think it'll shrink forever. I think that there is, you know, I would say that golf itself, there's really nothing wrong with golf itself. The game itself is great and doing great, and probably there's never been a better time to be a golfer. But what happened was we built too many golf courses, and we built too many golf courses for non-golf reasons. We built golf courses near people. And I include we, because we're in the business too. It was all of us in the golf business. We wanted to find locations near large groups of people where we could build golf courses. It didn't matter if it was a good site for golf. It didn't matter if there were high tension wires. We were going to put houses on both sides of the fairway to sell real estate. We could make them as hard as we wanted to. They weren't being built for the right reasons. And a lot of those golf courses are going to struggle and continue to struggle. But the well-designed, well-located golf courses, well-managed golf courses are thriving, and they're going to thrive. And that's why you see, you know, some of these locations, Band and Dunes obviously being a big one, but Stream Song, now Sand Valley in Wisconsin, these are golf courses built for the right reasons, because they are great golf. They're in great natural settings, or what feel like natural settings in some cases, for golf, and people are flocking to them. So, you know, and look, it depends on which parts of it you look at and the manufacturers and the rounds. But I can tell you, here's another example. I can tell you we're having an incredible heat wave in Chicago right now. And we manage about 15 courses in Chicagoland that we opened, and the demand has been amazing. We'd sell out the tee sheet, you know, an hour after announcing that we were going to open a course.
people want to get their fill in as fast as possible. Something you said I found really interesting, and I think it's something that I feel like golf companies and architects are tackling now that they never tackled before. And I have absolutely no reason why we ever went here in the first place. You mentioned it. You said golf's hard. You know, they built these hard golf courses with OB on both sides, and it was you're basically trying to hit it down a road like you're in Tin Cup. And I have seen this move a little bit towards golf courses that are a little bit more playable, something that, you know, one of the GMs at Castle Stewart told me over in Scotland a couple of years ago. They said, we're in the entertaining business. I mean, we have double-digit handicaps for the most part coming over here to play. Why would we want them to walk off this golf course getting beaten up? Is that something that you guys have taken into consideration and tried to apply to your golf courses as you set up to build them? I mean, you know, the designer's there, but asking maybe, hey, let's not make this thing where these guys are going to shoot 13 shots over their handicap. They'll want to come back, I feel like, more often than not.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was a trend in the U.S. for a while to say, gosh, I want to build this golf course in case I host a big tournament.
Exactly.
And it was a course that was probably never going to host a big tournament, and barely anyone would ever play from the back tees. And I like to credit Mike Kaiser for saying, you know, at Bandon Dunes and Pacific Dunes, and the architects, David and Tom, working with him and listening and consulting with him, let's build this golf course for the retail golf. Let's build it for the people that are actually going to come here and play it. And it's not that it's not too easy, I promise you. I mean, there's plenty of challenge in these courses, but let's make it wider. Let's allow people to hit a fairway. Maybe they're on the wrong side of the fairway and they have a really tough angle to get to the green, but they're going to find their ball and be able to hit it. And let's make the fairways wide. Let's make the greens a little bit bigger. And I think that's what we've found, at several of these places and with several of these architects and Bill Corr and Ben, with Tom Doak, now Gil Hance. And David Kidd's been interesting because he sort of started that way at Bandon, and, you know, he fully admittedly got caught up in, I need to make this harder. And he built a few golf courses that were really hard. And now he's sort of back to, I want to do, you know, Bandon Dunes may be his most successful course. I want to get back to what made it successful. And part of that is the playability.
Yeah, I mean, it's in my opinion, the most playable golf course at the facility. And I feel like 9 times out of 10, when people leave there, when they ask what was your favorite experience, not your favorite course necessarily, but I feel like favorite experience, a lot of people say Bandon. And it's because, again, playing solid golf and playing around your handicap, I feel like is a very underrated part about a golf trip. I mean, if you go somewhere and you get your butt kicked day in and day out, I feel like you're going to get on that airplane home and just, take that big breath and just, I got to get home. But, you know, you guys have focused on some resort spots. I mean, you've mentioned Bandon, you mentioned Sand Valley, you've mentioned Streamsong. One thing that I have been interested in seeing the evolution of as we continue to try to reach different groups of people in golf is the kind of mom and pop golf course that's good. You know, not the tree line one we've talked about, but a very solid mom and pop golf course, you know, that might be $30 or $40 to play. Are you guys at all looking out at that, you know, not just in the near future, but, you know, in the next 10, 15 years as something you might approach to get more people involved? Because if they start there, they might eventually move, you know, to a Streamsong or do a vacation at Bandon?
You know, absolutely. I think facilities in golf are actually quite diverse. And our company is very diverse. You know, we still manage the first course that we ever were hired to manage. It's a 9-hole municipal course in Vernon Hills, Illinois. And it's a, you know, great course for juniors. So it's got a men's league. I mean, there's good players there like there are at any course. And, you know, we all the way to these various resorts we're talking about are private clubs. So the facilities in golf are very diverse. And a lot of those courses you're talking about have really good bones. And they are good courses. They were well designed, and I think that is sort of a funnel, perhaps to people that may step up and travel to some of these resorts someday. But it really doesn't have to be. It's its own market. I mean, frankly, every golf course is so unique in that most of their customers come from about a 30-minute drive, and that's what makes all these properties so unique. The customers are all different. The needs of those customers are all different, and that's what excites us as a company, and that's why, you know, we're not a one-size-fit-all company. Look, the people down in Florida want their, you know, tuna salad sandwich different than they do out in California, and we know that, and there's not one solution for each one of these places, but there's a lot of those great courses in that $40, $50 range, absolutely.
And I was just going to ask, is there a mandate now when you guys put up a golf course? Because it does seem like a lot of them have similar attributes, you know, par three course, putting course, stuff like that. Are these things that you're implementing at all your facilities, even if they don't have them? And when you do build a new place, making sure that those are available for maybe somebody that didn't want to go out and play 18 holes?
You know, not necessarily. It's not right for every facility. I think, you know, one reason we've seen some of those types of facilities be built is, you know, because Bandon Dunes did open, what now, 17 years ago or 18 years ago, and the baby boomers are aging, and our customers are aging, and guys that used to walk 54 might only walk 36, guys that walk 36 might only walk 18, and, you know, so for other things to do, a par three course, maybe playing a scramble or, you know, something like that is a great alternative, or going to the putting course. It's so much fun. You actually realize how much fun it is just to go putt and have a couple cold ones, maybe gamble a little bit on the putting green with your buddies. I mean, it's really a fun experience, but that doesn't mean it's right for every facility, certainly that we manage, in terms of what space do you have. You know, are people, is it a place where you're busy and people are just coming to play golf and get out of there? Are they coming to practice? You know, everyone's a little bit different.
Well, you know, we talked public golf. I wanted to reach a little bit into private golf and mainly country clubs. Do you feel like the country club model will survive the test of time as younger people come up into the game? I mean, I'm 33. Over the last probably 3 or 4 years, I'd say almost all of my good friends that didn't play golf now play golf. So I almost feel like this is like the sweet spot age for people that come up. They can't play baseball anymore. They're not playing as much pickup hoops. You know, they're looking for something competitive. But the one thing I have noticed with young people is they don't like to do the same thing over and over again. They want to explore. They want to travel. And I feel like sometimes that country club mentality is a little bit old school. Do you think that has a chance of surviving, you know, as we move forward in these new generations?
Well, I do. I really do. You know, at certain clubs, you know, old line clubs that are generational, kids that grow up in areas that are near these kind of generational old line clubs, that grew up potentially as members of clubs or grew up with friends that are members of clubs, or now, you know, graduating from college, getting into jobs where their network is important and who they know is important. You know, I think there is a place for those old line clubs in many of the major metro areas in the U.S. And I don't think those are really ever going away. People long to belong to those clubs. Do as many people? Probably not, but that's never been a huge part of the numbers of golfers, frankly. I mean, that's a small number, just because of the sheer, you know, expense and of those types of facilities. But they do exist. They're okay. They're great for what they are. They're not for everybody. They have their rules, and rules aren't for everybody. I do agree that, you know, tastes are changing a little bit, and certainly young people want to have their phones available. They might want to untuck their shirt. They might want to wear their hat backwards, you know, but I don't think at these clubs, a lot of those clubs are never going to change those rules. I never is a long time. I won't say that, but that's just not the kind of club they are. And as parents, sometimes you may want your kids to behave differently at certain places. You know, so I think there's a place for those clubs. I don't think every club that's been built to be a private club will survive. Again, the ones that are well-designed, well-located, well-managed, you know, will survive. And I don't think that private clubs will go away in the United States.
What are some characteristics that you look for as a company when you're evaluating a property for the first time, or you're thinking about taking over a property?
Well, you know, there's different things, really. You know, if we're have an owner that's asking us to come in and look at it as we would manage it, I mean, you're really looking at everything soup to nuts. I mean, obviously the golf course first, in terms of design, aesthetics, conditioning, location. you know, we basically would do what we would call this price quality analysis, where we would look at all the characteristics of the facility and then look how that fits in with the other facilities in that market, knowing again that most of the golfers come from within a 30-minute drive. So, you know, we've all seen, you know, been in the marketing class where you draw a circle around your property and you can see where all the other properties are and you know kind of who you compete with. And we see how that facility fits in terms of the amenities and the characteristics and the price, obviously. So we kind of look at the relationship between the facility and all of its amenities and characteristics as against the price and the value versus its competition. And then we can come up with a business plan to hopefully make it successful. We can find the areas that maybe have been lacking that we should focus on to make that facility successful.
What positive feedback do you feel like you receive the most from first-time visitors that head up to one of your properties?
You know, hopefully it's the people. You know, in this time of oversupply in golf, in golf courses, I should say, you know, you really have to differentiate yourself to succeed. You really have to be a well-managed place. And what we decided to do as the downturn in the economy and the building of too many golf courses was kind of a double whammy. We realized that great service had to continue to differentiate us. So we invested in True Service, which is our proprietary customer service training program. And so I hope my favorite thing to hear is, man, the people were really nice. We had this issue and they said yes. We had this issue and they did it for us. That's my hope. Of course, great greens too.
That's hey, speed of play, pace of play, green speed, and being nice, and the group you're with, I feel like are the three checklists to make sure you're having a good day. So I have to ask, on the flip side, what's the most, I guess, the most popular negative feedback that you receive from somebody that's visiting one of your properties for the first time?
Well, I think any property in golf, you know, pace of play is one of the biggest negatives you hear kind of anywhere you go in golf, not just our facilities, but any facility. I think that's a huge focus for all of us, and sometimes it's even exaggerated. I know if I'm waiting, I feel like I've waited for 6 hours, but maybe it wasn't 6 hours, but that's what I feel when I get off the course sometimes, and that's the complaint you hear. So, you know, I think that could be a common one.
Well, what is a place like Abandon or Sand Valley or a Stream Song? What are you guys working on to improve pace of play? Because, you know, people are coming there, they're spending their money, they want to enjoy the day, but as you said, I mean, you don't want them out there for 5.5 hours because other people, it's going to ruin other people's experience. So what are some things you guys are working on moving forward to try to up that pace of play just basically across the board?
Yeah, I would say a couple things. You know, one thing you have to realize, and this has been a problem with some of the sort of national pace of play programs that people have put out there over the years, and we've used them, and, you know, anytime you're focusing on it, it's a good thing. But one of the things that I think has been missing, it seems rather simple, but it's kind of hard to execute. You know, if someone comes out and says, this is a 4-hour golf course, we'd be happy if people played in 4 hours. If for everybody on a busy golf course to play in 4 hours, the people that play first thing in the morning have to play in 3 hours. You can't start out at 4 hours in the morning. So training our rangers to realize, okay, here's a group that's first out in the morning, second out, third out, fourth out, the first hour, second hour, third hour. Yeah, you know, there may be a pace rating on the course that's 4 hours, but those need to be our pace setters. They need to get up and get out of the way. And what's nice at some of these facilities is, you know, the people that play early are mostly ones that want to finish early, whether they want to get home or get on to another 18 holes if they're at a resort property. So there is a little bit of self-selection. And we have to work on those. We have to work on those people a little bit harder in the morning to get them to set the pace. And I'd say the second thing is, pace of play is everybody's job at a facility. It's not just the Rangers' job. And you have to do it in such a tactful way, though. I mean, people don't want to be pushed around, especially people that are paying $100, $150 for a round of golf. You know, people don't want to feel like they're being pushed all the time.
Oh, I worked at a golf course in North Scottsdale when I got out of college, and one of our outside service jobs was to ranger. And I hated the thought of telling these people that were spending, in peak season, some $300 a round of golf to hurry up. I mean, I hated it because I kept putting myself in that seat. I kept thinking, if I was playing here and we'd put a credit card down for $1,200 for the foursome, I wouldn't want anybody bugging me and telling me to go faster. So as you said, it's such a fine line to skirt. One thing I've always wondered about is, you mentioned the pace setters. I've always wondered if there's like a reward system. If you guys finish in under 3.5 hours, we'll give you 10% of your money back. Something to actually, that they can actually hold in their hands after the round to say, you did a really good job today of getting around the golf course and setting the pace, for the rest of our afternoon.
Yeah, no, that's a great idea. And places we've tried it, one of the issues that comes up with that is you get a group behind another group that would easily be playing in 3.5, but now they're waiting. And not only are they pissed because they're waiting, but now they're pissed because they're not going to get 10% of their money back. And you've seen some videos on social media of fights on golf courses.
Absolutely. You don't want that.
We want to try and avoid that. But it is a serious issue. And I think, I learned a valuable lesson as general manager when I left Band and I came back to Chicago and I was general manager of the Glen Club. And I remember we were having pace of play issues. And a lot of these Rangers are kind of retired, successful. People have been way more successful than I was. And I remember I went up to one of the Rangers and I said, we've got to pace of play. You got to get out there and talk to him. And he's like, listen, it's not that easy. You come out there with me and talk to him. And I went out there and talked to him. And it was just a great lesson because, as you've said, it's a really hard thing to do. And in our business, a lot of times we take the retired, guy who's really working at the course just for golf privileges and, not making that much money. They're retired, successful guys. And our highest paid guys are inside the pro shop or in the restaurant or the general manager. They're not going to deal with one of the biggest issues in golf. And if you have to go out and talk to these people, it's probably better that some of your higher paid people go do it because you have to be very diplomatic.
It sounds like you're throwing out an idea of like an undercover boss type of situation for a lot of GMs and head pros. You go Ranger for a few minutes and you let us know how it goes. But it is interesting. It's definitely it's a slippery slope when you go up to a group that's a little slow and go, hey, hurry up, and they all shoot you a look. But that was a long time ago. Thank goodness I don't have to do that anymore because it made me super nervous every day I went to work. One last thing I wanted to ask, and it's an exciting thing for you guys for sure. A place like Bandon Dunes, somebody told me this year that outside of the Augusta National Masters logo, it's the most noticeable and recognizable golf logo and logo in all of sports. And I just wanted to ask you, you're hosting the Amateur, and for a place that's so popular and has so much play and, is booked up really year-round at this point, why put yourselves through the rigors of hosting an enormous event? The U.S. Amateur is the biggest amateur event in the world. Why do that knowing that the courses will be closed for times and, you won't have play on those for certain times and certain weeks out of the year as you guys get nearer and nearer to this U.S. Amateur?
Yeah, I think a lot of that starts at the top with Mike Kaiser. He has always wanted to support the amateur game. He's all about the amateurs. It's the amateurs that come and play Bandon Dunes and will go play Sand Valley. And, so giving back a little bit, to the game, I guess is one way you could look at that. And frankly, it's an honor. I mean, you have to remember, as we started this conversation, there was a time when, no bank would loan Mike money to build Bandon Dunes, and people maybe thought it was somewhat of a crazy idea and little Bandon, but now to host the biggest amateur championship in the world, you know, it's an honor, and it's an honor for, you know, as Mike would think, it's more an honor for the people that work for him. These are people coming to our little town of Bandon, Oregon, that are the best amateurs in the world. So it's really neat to be on a international stage like that. So I'd say those are the two reasons, you know, giving back to the game and seeing your baby, you know, Mike's baby, on an international stage.
Yeah, I was a part of the USGA coverage with Fox during the four ball a couple of years ago at Bandon. And I was there for so long that I went to get breakfast the last day, and the waitress said, "You're still here?" I said, I'm not sure anybody's ever. I'd stayed after. I had some family come. And we played golf, and I was like, "I'm not sure anybody's been here for nearly 2 weeks before." It's just, you know,
well,
I was working the
lucky
first week, so I'm excited about the amateur. I'm fired up. You know, I mean, we're gonna get to cover it, so I'll get to spend another lengthy stay, of course, around Bandon as. A guy, a younger fella living in that area at the time, what was it like living in the town of Bandon? Because I'm only assuming it had to have been smaller than it is now, which it's still not very big.
You know, it was, there's times, you know, you just can look back on parts of your life as your favorite times. You know, a lot of people say college is their favorite time of life, and certainly it's up there. But you know, that time living in Bandon Dunes, living in Bandon, Oregon, and working at Bandon Dunes, you know, my wife moved out there with me, and we had one son when we moved out there, and then we had another one was born while we lived out there. It was the greatest. It, you know, we hired great people, and, you know, sort of the people at the resort that you worked with became your friends, your extended family. And it was just such a fun and exciting time and such an exciting thing to be a part of. And I'll tell you what, you know, waking up and getting to see that ocean every day is a very, very special thing. You know, people say Bandon's in the middle of nowhere, but it is right on the Pacific Ocean, you know, right off Highway 101. A lot of people drive up and down that road and see the natural beauty of this country. I mean, it's one of the most beautiful places in the country.
Oh, and the town is, you know, for people that have gone to Bandon Dunes and never ventured into the town of Bandon, I will tell you, next time you go, do it just for an afternoon, because when it's a nice weather day, it is one of the more, you know, cool spots in the country. I mean, people are walking on that boardwalk and the caddy bar's right there. I mean, you could probably carry a beer across the street if you wanted to. I don't think anybody would say anything to you, but you know, it's a cool little city. It really is. So, you know, I could only imagine living around there. I mean, I'm sure the community is pretty close. So, it was, you know, it's a special place. It's, you know, it's my favorite spot in the country. So, anytime I get to go back there, I get excited. Josh, I appreciate you taking some time. I know you're busy. I'm excited. I get to go to Wisconsin in May and check out the facility there. So, a lot in store there as well. And I got to get back to Nebraska. I got to take my dad to Nebraska at some point, because first of all, as you know, of all the places that you guys manage, there's no beds better than the Prairie Club bed. No beds. And they even sell the sheets at the front desk because they got asked so much about them. They had to start selling them there. That's how good that night's sleep is. So if you've never been to Prairie Club, just get excited about your night's sleep.
Absolutely. You know, that's funny, because at Sand Valley, you know, we had, last year was just a preview year, but we had a few of our rooms open at Sand Valley, and people want to buy the mattresses there. So I'm just giving you a heads up right now.
Oh, no. I'm never going to get back. I'm not going to leave.
The mattresses are so comfortable. The beds are so comfortable. And as you know, if we're walking at least 36 a day, you really fall into that bed at night. That's an important part of the experience.
A good shower and a good bed if you're going to walk 36. Is Spotted Cow on tap at Sand Valley? Do you know this?
Spotted Cow will be featured at Sand Valley. There's no doubt. You can only get it in Wisconsin, and we better have it.
It is the best. Josh, again, I appreciate your time. I'm excited about my trip in May and excited about catching up on down the line.
All right, Shane. Hey, thanks a lot for having me.
Well, that'll do it for this week's Clubhouse. Many thanks to Thomas and Josh. Great conversation. Now I want to go to Bandon Dunes, for goodness sakes. As always, if you could, give us a follow at the Clubhouse Pod on Twitter. You can follow me at Shane Bacon on Twitter. You can follow us on Facebook at Shane Bacon Golf. We gave away a Callaway driver last week. We gave away an epic Callaway driver to one of the newsletter followers. We have a lot of stuff to give away as we get nearer and nearer the Masters. I've got a Tiger Woods book about his 1997 win to give away. We've got Arby's head covers. I, of course, got those clubhouse koozies. So follow along on Twitter, all the places I told you. Make sure you sign up for that newsletter. If you go to my Twitter page, at Shane Bacon, the link is pinned right there on the top. An easy way to keep up with golf news and to keep up with what's going on around our world. We are getting closer and closer to Augusta National. We've got some exciting news about plans around the Masters as well, so stay tuned for that. I hope you guys have a fantastic next couple of weeks. I won't be around, as I mentioned, but there are some old podcasts to check out here on the Clubhouse. If you go to SoundCloud or iTunes, they're there. I hope you get to play some golf. Hope the weather remains warm where you live and you make some birdies. As always, I appreciate you following along. And if you like us, subscribe. You can write a review on iTunes. It helps us out. Plus, I will send you 12 good thoughts. All righty. Have a great week. Get out, play some golf, make some birdies.